Welcome to the talk show dedicated to the wine industry. It's All About Wine. With your host, winemaker, cellar master, vineyardist, and tasting expert, Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida State's Winery in Land O'Lakes, Florida. Call our guest line at any time during the live show at area code 646-727-3235.
Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is educate people and make wine less confusing and more friendly.
Broadcasting on blogtalkradio.com and worldwide, including the Armed Forces Radio Network.
How this show has grown from, maybe a couple hundred to over 40,000 people. And that's fantastic.
From coast to coast.
Basser, Kansas.
Deming, New Mexico.
Ithaca, New York.
Knoxville.
Lancaster County, Pennsylvania.
Lexington, Kentucky.
Montana.
Moscow, Idaho.
New Hampshire.
New Mexico.
Santa Rosa.
Sevierville, Tennessee.
South Dakota.
The coast of Maine.
The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Westport, Mass.
We really have had some neat people on the program. I love that. Alba Vineyards.
Blog.penlive.
Boys Lip Winery.
Brotherhood.
Camas Prairie Winery.
Candia Vineyards.
Hello, the Borgeses.
Eagle Springs Winery.
Flathead Lake Winery.
Free the Grapes.
Grapesandwine.cal.cornell.edu.
Heritage Vineyards and Winery.
Hershey Harrisburg Wine Country.
Holyfield Vineyard and Winery.
Hummingbird Ridge Winery.
Toy Soy of Wine.
Prairie Berry.
Rainborn Wines.
Rocky Top Wine Trail.
Sheila Lauer Vineyards and Winery.
Southwest Wine.
Haber Hill.
Ten Spoon.
University of Kentucky Extension.
Vineyard at Hershey.
Vibach Winery.
Walt Vineyard.
Westport Rivers.
Wine Flower.
And around the world.
TheDriftingWinemaker.com. I just arrived in Bali about 3 days ago.
All About Wine is on.
If you have any questions or anything to talk about, we will be more than happy to talk to you about or search it for you or try to find information for you out there, because there is a lot of information out there about wine.
We do occasionally get off topic.
Delvoir Winery.
The most well-known haunted winery in the Midwest.
I've heard voices at the winery.
Call area code 646-727-3235 and let's talk about wine on air. And now, wine enthusiasts and industry representatives, All About Wine is on. Here is your host, Ron.
Thank you, best people. Mike's not with us again tonight. I don't know why, but hey, I guess, he's got his job and he's doing that, working that. So that's okay. He is on RadioDJMike.com. He is doing his radio programs every Friday and Saturday night. So check that out, RadioDJMike.com. He does a great job on those, and it's always good, and it's always fun. And he takes requests, and he does all sorts of good stuff. And you can IM him and all different ways to get a hold of me. Well, we are bus people. I'm real happy out there. It's a little bit warmer. I think we're sitting in about 66, 67 degrees now, with apologies to all of you around the country who are sitting in feet and feet of snow and getting more in some areas too. That's the sad thing about it. So our apologies go with you, but hang in there. Summer will be back and you'll be complaining about the heat before you know it. We have a guest tonight. We're still in Utah, as we have been in Utah for the last couple of weeks. It's amazing. Utah, I had listed as 8 wineries, and I'm getting more guests out of the 8 wineries in Utah than I am out of the 250 of them in Texas. It's just amazing. I don't know why, but thanks, Utah and Texas. You still have your chance. We can still do some interviews with you. That doesn't mean that you can't get on the program, but I'm happy that we're getting such a good response out of Utah here. So, since Mike isn't with us tonight, I need to go get our guest. We are still, like I say, in Utah. I'm going to have to give you a little breakdown in Utah too. We were talking last week and, where the roads are and where the things are and all that. And since they got the mountains around it and everything, it's a little bit different than some of the other states that we've talked to, but not tonight. I will save that for a different date. Next week, we will not be on. It's a Thanksgiving here in America. If you're listening to us from another country or something, Thanksgiving here in America, we will not be on next week, but we will the week after that. We got another guest from Utah the week after that, too. So stay with us. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about in Utah wineries and things and what's going on there. And so without further delay, I am going to give you a little background music here. I'm going to go get our guest, and I will be back real soon. All right, we have our guest. He's waiting for us in the green room. Let me go bring him in here. And hello, Jay. Welcome to All About Wine.
Thanks, Ron. It's great to be on.
I'm glad you were able to get on with us tonight. So, the Hive Winery, it's going to be fun because you keep yourself busy making more wines than I think any winery we've talked to.
I do love to create, and that's that's what it's all about. It's all about creating and having fun.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. I'm looking at your website, and it took me longer to go through and look at all the different wines than it does to than it does to read most of the other websites out there.
So yeah, Yeah, we've been making wine for 4 years now, and so far we've released 51 different wines and apple
ciders. Oh, my gosh.
And, starting a distillery, so we can do even more different products. And the rate I'm going, I figure by the time another 10, 15 years goes down, I'll probably have up to 200 products just because I
like to create. Oh, my gosh, yeah. And you're not going to have any place to put them. Either that or you're going to have to retire them every once in a while.
Yeah. Well, actually, we do them as seasonals because one thing that I've seen in a lot of places and certain industries is having a seasonal variety, something that changes with the season, keeps the customers coming back. And we also found out that once you get above 18 wines in your tasting room, people have a tendency to get shell-shocked and just kind of walk away.
I can imagine they would.
Yeah, we were up to 22 in our tasting room at one time, and it was like, whoa. And I was surprised how many people just kind of looked, kind of got shell-shocked and left.
Well, we have 9 wines at the winery there, and people go, 9? You know, by the time I taste the last one, I won't remember the first, you know, and that's just 9. I can imagine what 22 would be like, you know.
Yeah. Well, Utah, we're only allowed to let them try 5 of the different wines. So,
oh, yeah.
Our laws don't let them try more than 5. So the hard part for them is to pick wisely.
Oh, I didn't know. I'm finding out more things about the Utah laws all the time here. So,
they're the craziest, nuttiest laws in the world.
Yeah, I'm realizing that. Let's jump back to the beginning. The Hive Winery, how did this start? Give us some history background, a little bit about it.
So the Hive Winery was a concept that came about in 2008 during the big crash. My wife and I are engineers. We actually own our engineering company. And when the crash happened and I had to lay off my first employee who was like family, it tore me up. And my wife, just tongue-in-cheek, said, hey, you know, if we start a winery, one, it's recession-proof, and two, we'd be able to maybe take a vacation since we'd gotten up to where we could, and then we started losing employees again. And she just kind of left it at that. And about 2 weeks later, I came back with a business plan saying, well, if we do this, we can start a winery as a hobby. And as the recession kept getting deeper and worse, the plan just kept getting bigger and bigger until finally in 2010, we got this thing started off the ground and legally started making wines in 2011.
Wow. So you recently knew 2011, 3 years in. So you haven't been there a long time.
No, we've only been we're Utah's fourth winery, and we've only been making. We're coming up on our 4 year for first batch of wine anniversary coming January 1st. Because in Utah the fees are so terrible that my license started on January 1, and I made wine on January 1st when we in the first year I was legally able to. We spent New Year's Eve making the must, and then I pitched the yeast for my ball drop and New Year's Eve thing, because that's when the state considers it wine. So.
Uh huh. So the name The Hive, is there any significance to that?
Utah is known as the Beehive State. The motto. I mean, that's the state nickname, is the Beehive State. We tried a lot of different names out there for the different things. And the Hive Winery, for what we wanted to do, using local fruits and honeys to make our wine, just kind of stuck and rolled off the tongue. And that's one of the best things, is to have something that people know and can roll off the tongue, and get a good logo that people can recognize.
Yeah, immediately. I mean, the bee, it catches your eye, and it's simple and it's easy, so that's a good idea.
It is, and we get noticed all over the state for that.
You said something. I want to back up a little bit. You said you're the fourth winery in Utah?
When we got listed, we were the fourth active winery in Utah. A couple had come and gone, but we were the fourth at that time.
Wow. You're up to what, eight or nine now?
I think, depending on who's truly active, because that's always true. I think the 10th one just got bonded, and he's actually my neighbor. I helped him get her done for his grape wines. I think we just got our 10th winery in Utah through the state system last month. And
wow.
It might only be our ninth. I got to double check that. But I consider it an active winery if you have a tasting room and a package agency. If you didn't have that and you're selling out of state, or you're only making it for private use, like a couple of the wineries do, they'd have no intention of selling it. I didn't consider those really active wineries, so that's why we put it as an active winery thing.
I see. While I think of it, too, your friend that you just started, I'd like to get him on the program since he's brand new and he's doing that. That would be fun to talk to him and all the trials and tribulations of just getting started and everything. So.
Oh, yeah, and he's still fighting it. Although I think he's got his production of license now, the Department of Agriculture is beating him up to make sure he's got everything in line in Utah before I think he's even allowed to start his first batch yet.
Oh, gee.
Yeah, he's moving up here from Arizona, so it's an interesting transition going from Arizona to Utah.
Yeah, because Arizona's pretty good. They've got quite a few wineries down there.
Yes, they do. And, yeah, he was – Dionysian Winery was one in Arizona. But since he lived in Utah, I thought, let's bring it up here. It's starting to get an industry. So
that was his mistake. I really would. I'll email you after the program's over and you can give me his
information.
I'll get
you his number. I can get you. Being president of the Utah Winery Association, I've got everybody's contacts who are willing to give it to me.
Yeah, and that's just something else I just found out last week, too. I was talking to Doug McCombs last week. He was a guest on the program, and I asked him if they had a Utah Winery Association. He said, yeah. He said, Jay's just starting when he got together and all that. And I said, I think Jay's going to be on the following week. And he says, oh, he's a character.
Yeah, I've been described as a little nuts. Yeah.
I said, well, someone who's making 50 wines has to be. it's unbelievable. So, you don't use grapes. Is that not correct?
No, that is correct. Northern Utah is not a great grape growing region, although we can do some varietals with how they would have to be listed from the TTB. They'd be either called a red or a white table wine. And the cost of making wines in Utah is so high that you have to make premium quality, or it's just never going to sell. So we make
Why? Let's back up there. Why?
Our taxes and fees in Utah are the highest in the nation by far. If you count for excise tax, most states call it excise tax. They kind of hide ours as what they quote-unquote is fees. But, my idea is if the government takes money for nothing to go for something else, it's a tax. If we sell it out of our winery, we pay 17% of the sale price to the state. So on average, for a $20 bottle of wine, I average $17 a gallon excise tax in Utah.
Wow.
The next closest is Alaska at $2.50.
Wow.
So, and really with what you have to make on the price of wines, most wines in Utah are at that and above. So it adds up fast. And every month I'm right in the state, just this month, with what I sold last month in my tasting room, wrote him a $3,500 check. And that's just, wow. Just to go to school lunch fee and administration because they can.
Oh,
so,
that
and then
amazing.
License renewals is $4,000. So it's very expensive to make wine in Utah.
I can imagine. I won't even tell you how low ours are compared to that. That is just...
Oh, I know around here, and I use them as comparison, where Colorado's 35 cents a gallon, Idaho's 42 cents a gallon. I think I may be a little off on those. You know, and so I use that as the comparison, and California's 20 cents a gallon excise tax, and we're paying $17. it's a tough bugger, but, you know, it's one of the things we're fighting. However... where the state, our state legislators tied our excise tax to the school lunch program. Basically, 10% of everything we sell goes to the school lunch program. We'll never be able to get rid of it because the PR of taking food from school children will never work.
Taking food from the kids, yeah. See,
taking food from kids. So I've already done the research on it. And there's no point in fighting it because the PR would be horrible.
Yeah. And, well, even if you can drop it down to just the 10%, though, I mean, but 17%, that's crippling. It really is crippling.
It's a tough thing to do. And with only being able to max produce 20,000 gallons a year under that before they double your taxes, so double that amount, no winery in Utah can really get that big. And after 4 years, I'm starting to push up on that limb. It's like, okay, that's another reason we're starting a distillery. What else can I toy with as I get so big? So.
Oh, that is just amazing. I just, you know, I mean, I look through the wineries, and we've been doing this since early 2009. January 2009, we started to go through the states. And, you know, I'm seeing hundreds and hundreds of wineries across this country, and in certain states are hundreds and hundreds. I get to Utah, and I saw like 8 of them listed. I'm going, 8? I mean, you know, that's...
And of the 8 you probably found listed, probably 3 of them were ones you're like, oh, they're not really selling wine. So,
exactly. Well, exactly. You know, and that explains why. I mean, it's government, and we all know we've talked about government many times on this program. Yeah.
Yep, it's not a pleasant thing, but as I tell people, I chose to be here, so it's my own darn fault. But I also built my business plan knowing things wouldn't change.
Yeah, there you go.
So as long as you got the proper business plan. I am born and raised in Utah. I'm born and raised here, but not of the predominant religion.
Right around Salt Lake City?
Yep, I'm actually my office is literally 5 miles away from the house I grew up in.
Oh wow!
Didn't move very far.
Yeah, my daughter just moved to Salt Lake City. She works at the airport and moved from here in Tampa. I shouldn't say just; it's been a year now. But she lives up in Ogden, which is just north of you, I believe. There,
that's just north of me. Yeah.
Yeah, and so. She's wanting me to come out and visit her. When I do, I will visit you. So that's I will look forward to that.
Check out what, as we call it, ADHD winemaking looks like.
Yeah. Yeah, that should be fun.
But back on the question of why the fruits is Utah makes grows some of the best fruits in the nation with our peaches. They're some of the best peaches in the West. We export them all over the country for our peaches and a lot of our cherries and stuff. A lot of people think Washington for cherries, but Utah's a big cherry exporter too. So we grow some. We have great fruit growing regions. So that's why we chose to do fruit wines, and then honey wines, being the Beehive State, just made sense. And surprisingly, I learned how to make fruit wines about 3 years. Just about 3 years before I opened, and we've already won some pretty prestigious medals with the winning the gold medal in the Major Cup, the biggest meat only competition in the world. And it's been a fun thing to learn and do different things.
Wow, and so you're not doing any engineering anymore? You're just
I'm still an engineer. I was doing it yesterday.
Oh.
So we're still soils engineers, but we're working our way out of being soils engineers. The liabilities, actually, liability in being soils engineers is even worse than the state taxes in Utah. So I didn't pick my careers too wisely. But that's my like, it's my own fault.
Yeah, and you grew up there. You should have known that.
yeah, and also, as I tell people, why they say, why Utah? And, well, Utah needs it, and I'm a very stubborn man. So if I can't pull it off, I don't think there's many people more stubborn than me to try it.
And then you started the winery organization.
Association.
Association.
I mean, to work together as a group, I think any place where you can work together as a team, you have better chances of getting stuff done for state and legislative things. And I am a firm believer that, you know, other wineries in Utah aren't my competition. They're my colleagues. The more you work together, the better everybody does.
Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, and you just reaffirmed the thing I have been saying, talking to wineries around this country. I think everyone feels that way. Everyone thinks, hey, you're not my competition. You're my friend. And, you know, I have always said, if I have a problem with anything I'm doing, I don't hesitate to call up another winery and say, hey, I'm having this problem. Have you ever had it? What can I do? And they'll help. You know, and I think it's that way all over the country. Our enemy is the government.
Our enemy is the government, and I say the big boys. The big boys who I can't touch on price.
That's right. So,
in Utah, we've trained our drinkers to drink budget wines, and where there's only 42 state liquor stores mostly selling budget wines, it's a tough nut to crack. I mean, the average price, last I heard, the average price of a bottle of wine nationwide is like $24 a bottle is the average.
Yeah, that's the average price, but only because a few people buy those higher end ones. I think most people between $7 and $15 is what most people when they walk into a store walk out with.
For a grocery store, yeah. But the average price of the bottle sold in Utah is $9. So that makes it very tough. it's a tough nut to crack when you got to make a premium product for a higher price just because of the taxes and then competing against $9 Chuck.
And that's really tough. Oh, boy. Are you into liquor stores? Are you in all the state stores?
I am Utah's second best-selling winery. I've fought really hard over the year, but also with my model of going after 10% of the wine-drinking public because the fruit wine drinkers, I know the heavy-duty red wine drinkers aren't even going to touch my stuff, but I've gone after the people who are willing to try a lot of different things, and the fruit wine drinkers, and we've done very well in the state liquor store. And over the last year, we went from them selling about 15% of the total bottle count that I sold to this year they're selling 60% of the total bottle count.
Wow.
I sold.
Wow, very good.
And that's just in the last 12 months. Yeah, we've had some great growth. It's 80-hour weeks, but we're getting there.
Yeah, that's not counting your engineering job. Wow.
Yep, that's true.
So let's go back. You buy all of your fruits then. Are you growing anything?
I buy most of the 51 wines we've produced to date, 46 are made from local products. I try to buy as local as I can, but we can't get things like, you know, seasonal. You want to make cranberry wine. You can't get cranberries in Utah. You can't get pineapples in Utah. And I can't get enough strawberries in Utah. But everything else I try to get as local as I can, considering even my peach farmers, even though I'm in the eighth biggest metropolitan place in the United States, I've got a peach farmer 5 miles away from my place, and I buy every one of his peaches he'll sell me. So. And that kind of stuff. So buying as close as I can, because I'm a firm believer in locally made for local jobs, U.S. made for U.S. jobs on that. I mean, I've gotten to the point I actually buy my wine bottles from Gallo Glass, pay a little bit more for it, but I at least know the jobs are in the United States.
Right, yeah. And that's something else, too. Gallo, I'm bringing it up. They're doing a great thing with the donations to the Meals on Wheels program, which I always like to tell people about. But I didn't ask to, and I should have at the very beginning. Where are you located? I mean, where is the town of, what is it, Layton?
The town of Layton is located halfway between Ogden and Salt Lake City. I'm 20 miles north of Salt Lake City and about 10 miles south of Ogden, depending on how you look at it, right with where Hill Air Force Base is. Hill Air Force Base is partially in Layton, and so we're halfway between two of the more major cities in Salt Lake and in the Utah area, with Layton being the biggest city in Davis County.
Oh, okay. So you're
Out-of-staters, we say we're just north of Salt Lake. I mean,
just north
everybody
of Salt
thinks
Lake, yeah.
When we just say Salt Lake, we all kind of refer to ourselves as in the Salt Lake City region when we leave the state. So
yeah, well, that's everybody does that. You tell people the biggest city you're close to, you know, regardless of what it is, you always say that. That's just reference points that people use. So, do you use stainless steel, or do you use oak, or do you use plastic, or what do you do on your fermentation?
I use plastic flex tanks.
Very good.
I like the flex tanks. When I did my first research, they have smaller tanks, which allows me to go nuts on what I make.
Right.
And I started out with my very first order that I worked with was 18 30-gallon flex tanks and 8 70-gallon flex tanks. And then we've grown to where we've got, and those are on just the 30s and 70s, and we've been able to slowly grow with those flex tanks to where now we've got 48 300-gallon flex tanks. I've got 28 70s, and I've got 45 30-gallon tanks, and that allows me to have the variety I need to have as I make my wines. But I went for flex tanks because the maturation of a 2-year-old oak barrel without the oak flavor is a very important thing when you're working with wine. But then with a fruit wine. But then if I wanted oak, I can use lots of oak adjuncts and stays and those kind of things to do it.
That's what
I'm right
use,
now researching
then, right?
Things like okers and things. I've actually never oaked anything yet.
No,
I've
really?
Gone for the whole. I've never oaked anything. We're researching oak that we want to use, and we're already setting up our bench tests so that we can test oaking a dry black currant wine. I've also wanted to oak a peach, and everybody talks about an oak-matured mead, and I'm looking at that next.
Ah, a lot of people I've talked to are buying oak out of Minnesota. They're saying Minnesota oak is very, very good. So just
I think that's where those little ochre balls come from. So,
yes.
That I was actually considering where I like to control it to the tee. Those seem like a good way to look at.
Yeah. A lot of people I've talked to said that they've found that they're very good flavors and very good results from Minnesota oak. And, you know, I don't know. I just this is, you know, passing on a word to you, though. So
that's a great way to look at it, because I would like it locally grown. I mean, United States grown, for United States jobs. And everybody says French oak is the best. Well, you know, it's not American made.
Yeah, I know. It's French, yeah. And besides that, it depends on what type of structure, what you want to get to it. I mean, you know, so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's why you run bench tests, to make sure before you go all in.
You can
ruin something. It's a lot easier to play with 30 gallons than play with 300 gallons. Because once you've screwed it up, you kind of got to figure out what to do with it after that. So
now what am I going to do?
I've never had a problem with that yet, because I've always stepped my way into it. I always look at it as basically like a science experiment from my engineering side. So I've been pretty lucky with everything I've made. I've nailed them home run every time. Even when I gave myself a year to develop my cider line, I nailed it out of the park within a month and a half. So
you got so many wines. I have to chuckle with that. That drives me crazy trying to keep track of.
Yeah, I'm a crazy man, so I don't have to be driven crazy when you're already there.
You don't have to do it. Your wines. Let's talk about your wines a little bit here, and each one of them and all that. I've got your I've got your website up here in front of me here, so let you know I'm checking this out here. Your newest wine, your black currant.
Our Vintner Select Black Currant wine was actually our newest wine release, and that one is a straight black currant wine. It's a lot like our Pioneer Red. As I like to tell people, a lot of grape wines are aged in oak barrels to give them a black currant flavor. I just use black currants.
Yes, start with the black currant. There you go.
Yeah. We don't grow the grapes to get us there, so let's just use the black currants. And the more black currants you use, the more bitter it – I mean, the more higher tannins, the higher body, and you can go too far too fast on blackcurrants. So our mainline blackcurrant wine is a lot lighter. It's got a lot lighter on the blackcurrant side. It goes great with main course meal. A lot of people compare that to a nice light, not sweet, but a light red. And then we start adding, we double up the blackcurrants to make our Vintner Select, which is a mouthful of blackcurrants. And if you've ever eaten a fresh blackcurrant, you eat them on a dare.
Yes, I've had blackcurrant. You shiver if you know.
When I first started with blackcurrants, there's a local farmer in Utah who's actually the biggest blackcurrant producer west of the Mississippi, which isn't saying much. He only has 10 acres. But he said, hey, how about you try this fruit? And my first batch I made is a test batch about 3 years before I started the winery. It's like, okay, I'll give it a try. My first thought when I made the must, it's like, what have I done? I guess I'll be pouring it out. Well, I gave it a year of aging. It's like, oh, that's the stuff. And now I've got 6-7 different wines I make with blackcurrants and a blackcurrant apple cider because it's a fantastic base if you give it the time to age.
And you have to give it the time to get. Was it the pH and acids just jump so high at the beginning that you...
That they're just the pH and acids just up there, and when it ferments, you get just a. The only way to describe it is a flavor. And then just giving it the time to mellow out.
Oh, that sounds good. I'm getting excited because I will be visiting my daughter probably this coming summer. Mm-hmm. And you're right there. You know, I mean,
you'll drive within half a mile of my place driving up to Ogden.
Yeah, great. I'm looking forward to that. The blackcurrant honey wine.
Ah,
my
favorite.
The blackcurrant again. Is it your favorite?
Everybody's been asked me for the longest time what was my favorite wine, and I was able to get it down to my top five. And then over about another 8 months, that one kind of, if you ever got stranded on a desert island with one case of wine and it can only be one type, it's kind
right.
of how I was going on that one. And the blackcurrant honey wine has great characters because you've got the character of the blackcurrant, so you get the tannin, you get the body. And you get the additional body and characters of the Utah honey, which was a very I use a very heavy honey, so it's almost a baking honey. A lot of clover,
wow.
A lot of clover, and a lot of the local sage from the sagebrush in it gives it a great body to it, and they're very complementary with the black currant. So you get a great body, great character. But the only way I've ever been able to describe it is somebody think of a soft red. Kind of thing, but it's nothing like a soft red. But if you're trying to get an idea where your taste buds should end, think soft red, and then you'll at least be in the close proximity of where it ends up on your palate.
Oh, does that honey? You said clover and sagebrush. Does that give it any type of sweetness, or does the sagebrush honey?
The sagebrush gives it a. If you use too much, you can give it a medicine-y taste, kind of a menthol-y thing. But so you got to balance that out. On that, because the sagebrush is, if you've ever rubbed sagebrush petals between your hands, it does smell kind of a slight bit medicine-y. So you got to get a good mellow out, but it's got a great earthiness and great tones to it that helps just pull everything together. Some of my wines, I've learned that you can't use too much of that, because if you do the clover and sage honey with raspberry, some people start thinking it might taste like a cough drop, and that's not what you want in a wine. So
exactly.
We've actually been working with several of our different types of varietal honeys to craft out using the proper honeys to give you the richness when you finish with the clover and sage honey, but actually do initial fermentations on a straight clover honey that's a much milder honey to where the fruit forward is the main character, and then you finish it with the clover and sage honey to really give it the body it needs.
Okay, because I know clover honey is really, really the popular honey, and it's rather mild, and it's got that sweetness to it that's really unique. But when you start putting that sagebrush in there, I that's what I was asking. I couldn't picture that in my mind.
And it's got a fantastic body to it. And I've tried clover honeys on things. My first thought was, well, where's it at? So that's why when you go for your heavy, rich honey with all its sweetness and characters, it's a fantastic honey on its own. It's just a lot. It's just, as I like to say, I like it loud and proud. I mean, I'm the only guy wearing a yellow shirt and a sea of white and blue when I go to business meetings. I'm wearing a yellow shirt right now. And it's just a way to pull the characters together on it. And I love a full-bodied, intense honey. When I use it for making the wines, because it gives you the full body intense flavors.
So the strawberry honey wine, is that with the full body or is that with your clover?
It is. It's that was a full out with full out fermentation from the start to finish with that, and it's like having fresh strawberries with actually eating them out in a pasture. So if you're out there and you're smelling the alfalfa, no, I don't mean a horse pasture. I mean we out here our pastures are alfalfa fields and that kind of stuff. So you get the smell of being out, the feel of being outdoors eating a fresh piece, fresh strawberry.
Wow, that sounds interesting. The apricot honey wine, is that good apricot flavors or more toward the honey?
It's more towards the honey because apricots, unless you start using a lot of artificial flavors, you just can't really get apricot being your forward flavor.
Really?
I've tried every stunt I know with a good apricot, but apricots are so mild, even 100% apricot, the apricot's not the forward flavor on it.
Huh,
so you start, and when you start getting too much apricot, you'll start getting too much woodiness in your wines. So
well,
you got to work the balance of getting too much apricot for a fresh apricot without going artificially flavored.
Oh, I've never.
And I don't want to use any artificial flavors or colors. So when it comes to the apricot, nothing. I mean, people are like, why are you using fresh raspberry juice? It's so time consuming for your apple ciders. Well, I don't use artificial flavors or colors. I want it real. I want it natural. And I mean, even if it's a natural flavoring, I don't even use that. If it says raspberry, I'm putting raspberry in it.
It's raspberries. Oh, very good. Mm-hmm. Which leads us right to the next one, the raspberry honey wine.
It's another one of my favorites. And that's one we did a little tweaking with the clover and the clover sage honey to get it all to work out just perfectly. And the new one I'm going to be releasing here in a couple months, it's well ready. But when you have so many, you don't want to inundate your customers with too many at once. So it's a fantastic balance. The raspberries forward on it with the clover and then finishing with the rich honey. It's like raspberries covered in honey. It's super yummy.
And all of these now, too, I have to ask this before I forget. The apricot, the raspberry, the cherry, all these, the aroma, is it, what aroma is coming out on all these? Is it the fruit
fresh,
or
it is the fresh fruit. The fruit is the foremost, and the honey is the back note when you're smelling it. So it actually gives you a blend when you do it. So you'll get a light cloveriness and a light saginess on that side. But when you end up having it, it's the fruit is the predominant thing.
That's great. Bing cherry.
Yes, yeah. One of my favorites. And it's who we have a fun one. Yeah, Sister Wives Bing Cherry Wine, yep. So, that
said
one is...
Utah grows a lot of the Bing Cherries?
We grow a huge amount of Bing Cherries in Utah. We export a lot of pie cherries. I mean, granted, Washington is a little bit bigger than Utah, but considering how many people we have in this state, we export a lot of cherries. I get all my Bing cherries and my pie cherries from Utah. Bing cherry was actually the first wine I ever made as a home brewer and as a black cherry wine. And I go up to a local farmer. He's a good Mormon boy, and he's actually one of my now good close friend. And ask him, hey, I'd like to buy 800 pounds of cherries to make cherry wine. And he kind of goes, yeah, you're joking.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but he sold them to me, and then the next year I come back for more. And that's how I actually started learning to make wines is when I first got married, my parents had a Bing cherry tree in our front yard that produced close to 12 bushel of cherry that year. I mean, it was a huge tree. My mom, as we describe her, has a hyper green thumb. And I didn't know what to do with these cherries. My father-in-law goes, hey, you know what? How about you make a batch of wine with it? And that's where it all started. And he taught me how to make the wine. And I kept doing research on it, getting better and better and better. So after about 6 years, he goes, I can't make wine anymore. I can't touch what you're doing. So, and the other adage I like to say is my father-in-law drove me to drink, and I thank him every day for it. But he also taught me how to make wine. So, I mean, to learn from your father-in-law your craft.
Yeah, that's great. Well, the Preacher's Son blueberry.
Blueberry honey wine, yes.
The blueberries is also locally grown?
No, the blueberries are not locally grown. Although we have a couple of local blueberry farmers, nothing beats the Northwest in my region for blueberries. So I get them out of Oregon. They're sweeter. They got a better body and character out of Oregon. But all the honey, there's actually a lot more honey than there is blueberries in it. So that's why we say it's a local, you know, they use local products. You know, most of the cost in that bad boy is the honey. So on that one. So, But I get all my blueberries out of Oregon, sometimes Washington, depending on where I can grab them from. But they have better characters. Ours here, our blueberry bushes never get above your knee in height, and they're super strong and super acidic.
Yeah, and that's, Florida does a lot of blueberries, an awful lot of blueberries down here. And there's so many of them that are just what you described there, very acidic, very, some people actually refer to it as bitter, but it is just the acid that comes out too much on it. So,
that's why I like what comes off the Oregon coast. That's the region. That's the same back in Michigan. When I was a kid, I used to pick them back there with one of my family, go back and visit family. But the stuff coming out of off the Oregon coast, that is some of the sweetest, most fruit forward blueberries with low acidity I've ever tasted. It's kind of where I try to get them from.
Yeah, so if we see a package that says Oregon blueberries, then we should grab them right away.
I would say so. I mean, if they're grown too far inland on the in the desert side, they get a little more acidic. But if you can get them off the coast, wow, is all I can say.
And it reflects it in your wine. There you go. Blackberry honey wine. This is to me, this sounds the most interesting of them all. I don't know why, but just the blackberry just seems like it could really give some great flavors to that wine.
If you're a blackberry fan, I like blackberries. My wife loves blackberries. And it takes a lot of them. You can overdo it because every blackberry has a lot of tannic seeds in it. But the tannic seeds also help add character to it. Our blackberries here have a tendency to be a little more acidic, but that acidic is balances out really nicely with the honey. And again, I've learned a way to work the different types of honeys we have in Utah to really pull the flavors forward. And actually, if I got too heavy on the tannins, which I didn't on this one, you can always mask them a little bit with a different type of honey.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Well, you keep mentioning different types of honey and all that. Let's talk about some of the Hives mead wines, which are actually honey wines.
They're all actual honey, yeah.
Yeah, this is the sweetness. Honeys are sweet. I mean, if you can flavor stuff and get your sweetness with honeys and all that. Mm-hmm. So mead wines would tend to make you think that they're all going to be sweet, but are yours?
No, mine are not. Some are a little sweeter. I actually have four different sweetnesses of meads. I do a little different than your traditional mead maker. I ferment all my meads to dry, and then I post-sweeten to control the quality control. And that's what allows me to balance the tannins and characters of the all my melomals with the honeys at the end. So you're using an unfermented sugar, so you don't have even a slightly broken down sugar affecting your overall quality. So I found out as an engineer, it's like, why don't you do this? You get better quality control. And I learned later on that that's just not how it's done, but that's how I do it. and the TTB lets me do it that way. So that's how I make my meads. I'll ferment them all to dry. And then I can then use that same dry base wine to make the winter, spring, summer, and falls, which is a 0.7% residual sugar, a 2% residual, 4% residual, and a 6% residual.
Wow.
And the quality control is much easier to do.
It sounds like it would be. Well, you say you get your different honeys from different areas. What flavor honeys are you getting?
I get them all from one source in Utah. It's a honey farm I always grew up using, and they're one of the few that's big enough to handle all the honey I need. I have a lot of people, hey, you want to buy my honey? Yeah, you got 8,000 pounds? No. So I've got to kind of go with the bigger producers. I go to Cox Honeyland, and they have several kinds. They have I get their what's called their Cache Valley honey. It's the honey from all the hives around the valley, and it's an agricultural valley. So you've got the sagebrush on the edge of the mountains, and then they a lot around. And then you've got the clover, the alfalfa fields, and that's where we get your clover honeys, all the alfalfa fields. And so that's their main one. Then they have just straight clover honey, the ones that they know the bees are only staying in the alfalfa fields. They also have one that's a high mountain berry honey called a snowberry honey. That one's so mild, if I ever made a wine with it, you wouldn't know it was made with honey because it's just such a mild honey. on that one. Then they also have straight sage honey. And that sage honey, when you mix the clover and sage together, it's a very heavy honey. But the clover on its own is light, and the sage on its own is light. So when you mix them together, when the bees mix them together, it gets real intense. But the sage on its own is real light honey in itself, and it's a great one for putting on bread. But with the sage components I get in a lot of stuff with my clover and sage, the Cache Valley honey, it I would be a tendency if all I got was the mentholiness of it using a sage. So I haven't really gone straight sage yet, but I found out using the clover on some of my fruit wines to start with, and then finishing with the heavy body of the clover sage gives it a fantastic character.
It sounds wonderful. It really does. I have to ask, you know, the colony collapse syndrome that affected this country a couple years ago, did it affect any of the hives there?
It affected quite a few of them. And actually, one of my fellow winemakers who actually makes a honey vinegar from his wines, he had half of them collapse on him. And I mean, it didn't devastate his business, but I mean, his bees are like his family, it seems like, and he was torn up as if one of his family was killed in a car accident on that one. But he was able to grow it back, and there was quite a bit of that colony collapse, and it's still happening.
Yes.
But that's why honey prices have gone up almost double in the 4 years I've been making wine.
It's amazing.
It is amazingly expensive to make it. You know, they're working on ways to keep them together, and it's getting there. And we've got some great agricultural biologists in Utah. With Utah State University, my alma mater, they've got some great farm researchers up there that are doing wonderful things. And bees is one of the things they're looking at too.
All across the country. It's a serious thing.
Every ag college is looking at that, because bees is a huge thing. But I know they've got several research projects going at Utah State University right now on that.
Yeah.
So
I looked at making a mead, about 4 or 5 years ago. And that's when they started to report this colony collapse. And I'm thinking, wow. And I started to check with the people that I was going to get the honey from. And the honey prices went like triple from what they were, and so I said, "No, I'll wait," and I never did make it. So
the thing is, prices never came down.
They never came down. No, they jumped
they
up.
Never
and they
came
stayed
down.
There. Yeah,
it's like gasoline.
Yeah. It's coming down a little bit right now, but still, though, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
I noticed one here that the Christmas mead.
Yes.
It's
like drinking Christmas in a glass. What that is that's my summer sweetness mead that I've made. It's actually just the same, summer sweetness. And I've mulled it with high-quality mulling spices from Penzies out of Wisconsin.
Oh.
If you've ever tried the Penzies mulling spice, there's nothing. I've never run into anything half as good. And I'm a firm believer you get quality, you get what you pay for. And when you're paying $40 a pound for these spices, you get some dang good quality out of it. And I use their cinnamon, but their mulling spice makes a huge difference. I've already got people trying, and I don't do reservations except for my Vintners Club, because I can't really donate, I can't discount alcohol in Utah at all. So I've already got people lining up for our Black Friday release of Christmas mead.
Oh!
I only make 70 gallons of it a year, and it'll sell out in about a week.
Oh, my gosh. Save me a bottle. Put a bottle away. When I come out, I want one. Penzi, let's give them a shout-out here. Well, how do you spell that?
P-E-N-Z-E-Y apostrophe S. And I had a friend hook me into some of their spices for their Vietnamese cinnamon back when I was just getting out of college and couldn't really afford their high-quality spices. And I've tried all the other grocery store brands and have not been able to find anything even close on quality. So I believe you get the quality you pay for, and that's what I use for cinnamon sticks for when I do my peach cobbler or apple crumble wines. That's where I get my mulling spices from. And you know, don't even get a discount. I pay the straight-up retail price to get them because I just don't get enough for the cooking side of things, but fantastic spices.
You mentioned a couple of wines that sounded fascinating, to say the least. An apple crumb wine?
My apple crumble wine is one I developed from the state. Actually, I first made my peach cobbler wine. I kind of take it after my Dutch oven cobblers. I like to well, back when I wasn't so busy, go out and camp and enjoy cooking over a campfire with briquettes and things like that. And my peach cobbler wine is actually my Liquid Sunshine peach wine that I made with brown sugar instead of white sugar to give it a caramely characteristic. And then I aged, after it got finished, I aged on cinnamon sticks for a minimum of 6 months. So unlike mulling spices, that I got to watch it and test it every 6 hours because you can really get too bitter with the clover. The cinnamon sticks, once you pitch them in, you just let them go. And then with that one, because of its cost, I also tried to, in Utah State Liquor Stores, tried to develop one that could be more affordable. That's where we went for the apple crumble, which is the same except made with apple. It's an apple wine that we've done with brown sugar to give a kind of a caramely apple character, and then the cinnamon sticks. And it's fantastic, and it's hugely popular.
I can imagine it would be, yeah. Your Hives dual sweetness wines, the peach, the cherry, and, pie cherry, and the strawberry wines.
And now cranberry. We did cranberry dual sweetness this year, too.
So those are available all the time.
Not all of them. We're actually cutting back on strawberry. We found out which was the most popular of the two, and then when the state started carrying, it's like, well, I probably better focus on the one the state's selling. And right now we have peach in two different sweetnesses, and we're working on a few others with Bing Cherry and others, trying to get the differences to what our customers like, because everybody likes different sweetnesses. And one thing about being small and how I work my wines is I can make both dries and semi-sweet wines.
Jay,
and that way the customers
small.
Can really love it. What's that?
I said you are not small.
Yeah, well, when I started out, I was only making 1,000 gallons a year. If all goes well this year, I should be making about 15,000 gallons.
Yeah, you passed the small stage here. Your sparkling wine, Sisters Wise, that sounds very Utah-ish. What is your sparkling wine is made from Bing Cherry?
The sparkling wine is my Bing Cherry wine that since I force carbonate for my hard apple ciders, I wanted something sparkly for the Christmas season. For people to be able to pop open a champagne that didn't come from France, that wasn't mass-produced, that was hand-bottled, two bottles at a time. So we took our Bing Cherry wine. I gave it a tiny bit more sweetness because when you add the bubbles, you want a little more sweetness to it for the carbonic acid. And we force-pressurized it. It's a light carbonation. And then we pay the very high champagne tax on it, for sure. And we force carbonate it and then bottle it. And we don't, since I don't have a huge high-quality bottler, I can only bottle at 30 PSI, which is about twice as bubbly as your standard beer, but half as bubbly as a standard champagne.
Oh, but still bubbly, though. That should
and it's still bubbly, and my customers love it. They're lining up. That's one I always release right before Christmas so that people can have it for their Christmas and New Year's Eve. And say it's one of those I've only got 12 cases of, and the customers are already lining up for that one, too.
Oh, gee. We're talking the Hives single sweetness wine, rhubarb. I tasted a rhubarb wine out of Idaho. I had I did an interview with a gentleman up there.
Yeah, the one up there in Coeur d'Alene, huh?
Yes, it was. And that was interesting. I was surprised. I've had rhubarb pies before, but the wine surprised me. Is yours along that same line?
Mine is a dry rhubarb wine. It almost tastes like a at first I was I'm not a rhubarb fan, but I've always told my customers, this is a Utah winery. If you really want me to try something, we'll try it. And I had a customer who wanted it so bad, he brought me the rhubarb. And I'm like, okay. I always take a bite of the fruit to begin with and figure it out from there. And my first bite of the fruit is like, but I fought it through. I fought through the process of getting the juice out, soaking it on sugar, and that didn't really work commercially. Then this year we did a little different process with it, and the rhubarb came out by crushing it and then just fermenting it like normal, but only giving it 5 days. And it gives it you can taste it next to a rosé, and you're like, wow. We kept it really light on the sweetness with only 0.4% residual sugar, just a little to knock off the sting of straight alcohol on that one. And it gives it a nice rosé characteristic. You get the rhubarb with it, it's almost like rosé.
4% residual sugar is just about
0.4%.
0.4. Oh, wow. 0.4. You're really low on. I thought you said 4.
Really low.
0.4. That
yeah.
is
yeah.
dry.
At 4%, that's a little. The winemaker can't drink them that sweet. I'm getting old, so the winemaker can't drink them as sweet as a lot of my customers do. I'll make them where it sells the best, but I'm working on some more drier and drier wines because, as I say, I found out with my research that if you don't have at least 1.5% residual sugar in most fruit wines, you'll have this great aroma and your tongue gets cheated.
Yes.
So
yeah.
I've been balancing.
Exactly. I know what you're saying. Yeah.
I've been balancing out the difference between it, and I find out most fruits really start to sparkle between 1.5% and 3% residual sugar, which are way on the drier side compared to most fruit wines nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I try to make them dry enough to go with your main course meals. And what's that?
No, I was just saying, so your black cherry apricot wine, that's a 1.5 residual sugar you say here on here. So that
yes.
tends to be a bit drier too.
Mm-hmm. About a third of my wines are 1.5% residual sugar, just sweet
yeah.
enough to pull out the fruit, but not overly sweet.
Does this black cherry apricot come out more black cherry, or?
It actually was with the balance we had on that one. I got to make that one again. I didn't get a chance to make that this year because the apricots got frosted. That one, you had the. I used about six. I do believe it was 60% apricots, 40% black cherries. If I remember correctly, it's been 2 years since I made that one. And the black cherries gave it the great forefront with the finishing of the acidity of the apricots.
That sounds fascinating. And then you have one here that doesn't really say what it is. Black Magic.
Ah, Black Magic. That is blackberry blackcurrant wine.
Ooh.
So the blackberries, it's a lot of blackberry mixed with our similar strength to our black. It's our blackcurrant Pioneer red wine. And so we balanced it out in such a way that the black currants give you most of the body, and your blackberry gives you your fruitiness. So you're getting a lot of blackcurrant body in the fruitiness of the black berries, and it's a wonderful combination. And we actually, we tried to only sell that in October, and I was even having a customer trying to beg for some today, and like, sorry, we're out till next year. So, it's one of those I'm working on making right now for next October. So,
that just said the blackberries. I just, two fruits there that sound great together. That's exciting.
And it was one of those. I always wanted to make one called Black Magic for Halloween, and it just seemed appropriate. And then we tried them together. It was fantastic. It was one of our first fun labels. And then we said, customers who bought it said, I love the label, thinking the wine was going to be terrible. It's my favorite wine. So,
it is a cool label there, too. I have to say, it is a cool label.
And we've been making some fun labels, but I'm a firm believer that fun labels are supposed to be fun labels, and you put fun labels on your on fantastic wines. I don't believe in putting fun labels on something just to sell it.
Yeah, that's a good idea. The Zion Curtain, the raspberry wine.
That is a 100% red raspberry wine.
100%?
And I made that one 100% red raspberry wine. You've got they can get pretty powerful on that one. It's one of my favorite five. You got great body and characters of the Utah red raspberries. Our higher climate sets the sugars, mellows out the acidity, and sets the tannins. So we get a great blend of red raspberries coming from our local farms. Bear Lake raspberries is one of those terminologies that's been used nationwide for a nice, sweet, mellow red raspberry, even though Bear Lake doesn't have any raspberry plants anymore. A blight went through and wiped them out before I got going. So I'm actually buying all mine from a raspberry farmer on the other side of that mountain, same mountain range even, just literally on the other side of that mountain that's one of the bigger raspberry producers in the state of Utah.
That's great.
The Zion Curtain's a smack on the Utah liquor laws. Now, all our mixed drinks and wines have to be poured behind a curtain so kids don't see them being poured or mixed.
Really?
And when that law
You're kidding me.
I'm not kidding you. That was my thumbing at the Utah State liquor laws because literally they have to pour all alcohol behind a curtain. So giving Utah liquor laws the raspberries. So.
That is, oh boy, that's amazing.
It's one of those weird ones.
Is a 2-time bronze medal winner out of the Finger Lakes International Wine Competition. So,
yeah, I know if I made it sweeter, it would do better. But I don't like sweet wine. So, I mean, most raspberries are 10% residuals, and I'm not a super sweet guy.
Yeah, keep that. Your cranberry wine, that's also a silver medal winner out of the Finger Lakes competition.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And is that 100% cranberry?
That is 100% cranberries out of Oregon. My first year I got them out of Washington, my second year out of Oregon. The Northwest is all a fantastic place to get them from, and like I said, it goes with my philosophy, keeping them close. And it is 100% cranberry wine. It's got great body and character. And this is the first year we did it both on dry and off dry. Our traditional is a semi-sweet, 2.4% residual sugar. And this year is the first year I tried it as a straight dry, and it's just like eating a fresh cranberry. You get that of being done.
That's what cranberries are. That's right. Yeah.
And it's a very popular wine in both our store and in the state's liquor stores.
I can imagine this time of year, too. That sounds like it would go great with a turkey.
Yeah, we release it in November. We try to have it sold out by mid-December.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. The blackberry. Excuse me. Blackberry wine. Is 100% blackberry, and is that semi-sweet here? What residual sugar on it?
That's a 3%. 3.01% being the engineer I am. It's a 3% residual sugar. It needed a little bit more to pull the blackberry out against its tannins, the blackberry. We do grow blackberries in Utah, but they have a tendency to be a little more tannic with those, a lot more seeds. But like blackberries in Oregon, you can bounce those bad boys. But here, if you pick them, they kind of break, they just melt in your hand. So you get great body, great characters. And there's a couple of new farmers starting to grow even Norbert blackberries, and those are fantastic. And I'm hoping to convince them next year to sell me some so I can make blackberry brandy with them. So,
ooh, yeah, blackberry. I love blackberries. I've always grew up with wild blackberry bushes around my house back in Missouri.
Yeah,
and always been a fan.
In a lot of states, they grow as weeds, and in Utah, we have trouble growing them. but blackberries is one of those great ones. I'm actually making a blackberry apple cider too. I pressed that same blackberries and used 7.5% of that fruit juice in our hard apple cider to flavor that too.
That sounds great. Also, we also have ourselves a silver medal winner at Finger Lakes and a bronze medal winner at the Tasters Guild International. Sisters Wines Bing Cherry.
Yeah, that's our straight Bing Cherry wine. Talked about Bing Cherry. Maybe it was Bing Cherry Honey Wine that we talked about earlier. Straight Bing Cherry wine is one we're poking fun at the local polygamist culture here. But that was one of my one from my local favorite farmer, one of my first wines I ever made. You get the body and the characters of the Bing Cherry, so you get your sweet cherry body, and we aim it towards, it's like drinking a fresh Bing Cherry.
Is how we make it. That little bite in there that the Bing Cherry gives you when you pop it in your mouth?
Yes, it does. It's not as sweet. I mean, my fresh Bing cherries when we made the brandy was, 17.1 bricks. We're only talking 4 bricks on this one when it's all said and done. It's 2.3% residual sugar on that one. So it gives you the characters of it without being overly sweet and all the body of the heavy cherry there.
And a Bing Cherry is really not that super sweet, though. I mean, if you pop one in your mouth, you're not going to get a lot of sweet.
And actually, we had a bumper crop this year. I mean, we had epic pollination rates this year, and he was just going to throw them away. That's why I decided to start a brandy distillery. I tried out my initial bricks were off the juice for crushing just straight Bing Cherries, and it had a bricks of 17 point. It was in the 17s on the bricks.
That's
just
amazing.
On cherries. Yeah.
Yeah, because you don't, I suppose you do, but I mean, most of your cherries,
the Bing cherries. You might be thinking like the Montrachet cherries, which are the pie cherries. These are your black.
Yeah,
the Montrachet cherries are a lot more acidic, and that's our pie cherry wine. So Montrachets are the pie cherry style. This is our Bing cherry, your summer sweet cherry.
Oh, okay. Your blueberry wine. There's a lot of blueberry wines being made down here in Florida. Little shout out to Keel and Curly, which is located over by Plant City. They do 3 blueberry wines, a sweet, a semi-sweet, and a dry. And those are great. Yours is made more in a dry finish, I noticed here.
Previous years, because I had them stall out on me, were sweeter. But there was no point. They were perfect, so there's no point in fighting them to get them finished. After they'd stalled. But they still had high enough alcohol content. But this year we were able to get it to ferment to dry. I was switching up my yeast a little bit, and I was able to ferment it down almost to dry and get a 0.5% residual sugar on it. And since we had our Preacher's Son at 4% residual, we wanted it as a counterpoint. So those who like it a little drier and those who like it sweeter. And it's been a very, at first, a lot of my customers are like, oh, you broke something that was perfect. And then they taste what we were going for. And they're like, you know what, you've got a good point. Balance it out so you can use them both ways.
All right. Your alcohol, what is your average on most all these wines?
You know, the TTB allows you to be within a percent and a half on your label.
Right.
So I kind of make my labels in that. But my average alcohol content ends up being around 13.5.
Wow.
When it's all said and done and finished. Even though some of my labels say 12.5. Because sometimes not all the sugars break down. Sometimes some of the starches break down, and you get a little higher alcohol content. So we're averaging about 13.5 on most of our wines. Some of our meads are a little lower because that's a tough sugar to ferment. So I've had them as high as 16, and I found out that's fantastic for those of us who like a good strong wine. But some of my customers with the fruit find out that's a little dangerous.
Too much, all mine right are at 12. When you said 13.5, that surprised me. I mean, I didn't expect them to be that high.
And I like a little higher alcohol content to thin it down across the palate take care of the sugar. So if you add sugar, it gets thicker and thicker. So although I'm not adding much, increasing the alcohol smooths it out across your palate. So you're not getting this thick feel across your tongue. It's flowing across like any normal wine would.
Yeah, because of the alcohol, a little bit higher. Your pear wine, is that from Utah pears?
Utah pears all got blighted out about 10 years ago, believe it or not. My pear wine comes from I buy it from a local farmer who trades with the Mormon Church Farm out of Medford, Oregon. So I call him Utah Spot because, believe it or not, the Mormon Church Farm.
What happened? What happened? Did we lose him? We lost him. He disappeared. His call was dropped. Okay. Everyone stay with us. For some reason, the call was dropped, and I have no idea why. Let me call him back on here again. I'm going to put you all onto some music, and let me go get him again. Back online here, and all right, we are back. He had a power fluctuation. I was talking to my daughter the other day, and she said that when she's driving from Ogden down to Salt Lake City to go to the airport, every once in a while, the Air Force base causes her phone just to stop.
Yep.
And then it starts again.
I found out that occasionally they click that they have to test their jammers because, you got to make sure. And I find out that, too. An airplane will take off over the top. Yeah, I used to have my engineering company base office was just near the end of the runway, and it was talking along. All of a sudden, oh, here comes the roar of a jet. My phone's going to die. Sure enough, click.
Sure enough.
So it happens all the time. Even over here, they're getting high enough by here, but I still lose it here all the time.
That's amazing. So we were talking about, and let me go
about
back.
About the pear wine, if I remember correctly.
About the pear wine, yes.
Yep, I bought my pears from a local farmer. I thought he was growing them locally, but he buys them from he trades our Utah peaches to their cannery for pears. So he trades them 80 bins of our peaches for 80 bins of pears, and they take them up to the cannery and can them there for their social program foods. On that one. And these pears were rejected because they were too big for the peeler. Oh, darn. You know, 1 pound pears. It's a terrible thing to have.
Yeah, really.
And that's where I get them from. I don't think the Mormon Church knows I'm using their pears yet. Maybe they do that. I don't see them listening to your program, but maybe.
Maybe. Who knows? Your plum wine. That sounds good. I was reading this a little bit here about the plum. Are you getting a good plummy nose and good plummy taste, or is it more subdued?
It's more plummy. I always try to make it more front forward. So this was a very red fleshed, very plum forward wine. It's not an Italian prune plum, so you don't have the acidity, but you got the great plum flavor behind it.
And this is the next one here. I have been playing. I fermented a little bit of it. I've been playing trying to make a pomegranate wine, and I noticed you have one here. I am having one heck of a time trying to get a good balance of the flavors of the pomegranate. I'm going nuts on it. I grab myself a pomegranate, I take a bite out of it, I take a sip of the wine, and there's nothing like what I just bit.
Well, because we don't grow pomegranates in Utah, believe it or not, I buy my pomegranate juice from Costco. Palm Wonderful. When Costco has their sales from Palm Wonderful out of California, I found out it was cheaper for me to buy my pomegranate juice from Costco and work that.
That may be my
problem. It's one of those weird
then.
Ones, but a lot of pomegranate wines in the West are come out of Palm Wonderful's production facility. They'll sell it by the concentrated jugs and stuff like that. I get it unconcentrated and a little watered down. And we go, because the heavy expense of the pomegranate juice, we work it a little differently. But that's one that's – I'm not a pomegranate fan, but my wife will shoot me if I don't make it because she loves pomegranate. So I make that one for her. We make a small 30 gallons of that every other year to balance out against the rhubarb. But, again, it's – just have those people that just love rhubarb. So you make them small batches, and that's where we love having fun. We'll make batches as small as 30 gallons.
And that's not very many bottles.
That's only 150 bottles.
Yeah, that doesn't go far there. Well, the pomegranate, there's a local charity here that wants to work with me and do a pomegranate wine and then sell it for a little bit more, and proceeds go to them and stuff. And I'm battling this. Maybe I should just go down to Costco or Sam's Club and pick up some pomegranate juice and try it from there.
I first tested it on 5 gallons, and it came out much better than I expected. I even tried a pomegranate mead, but that priced it to where even customers are going, no.
We can't do that.
It's not that good for that expensive. So on that side, so sticking with that, we actually found a decent ratio there to not overdo it and not make it so expensive you can't afford to sell it.
But then at 15% alcohol, that's on your pomegranate.
Yeah, I had a tendency to get a little carried away on that one.
So pineapples, Utah is not noted as a big pineapple state.
No, we get a lot of salt flavor in our pineapples. No, I get all my pineapple from Costa Rica. Costa Rican pineapples. They're a little sweeter up front, a little less acidity, and it gives a great great balance. And it's one of those we're actually starting to rotate through three different pineapple-styled wines just because you can do too much. But when you release them in the spring, your customer's like, oh, it's a springy wine, so right around Easter on those. So we're actually kind of balancing between our pineapple, our apricot pineapple, and our raspberry pineapple wine, just kind of having a cycle between those three. But the pineapple, you get the nice acidity, the light acidity, and I didn't even have to adjust my acids on them. They come in decently enough. So I only had 0.6 on the free acids on it, even though the pH was around a 3.0. So.
And then the apricot and the raspberry pineapple wine, just this is all blends coming out with a little bit of flavors of the pineapple.
The apricot and pineapple were fermented together. The first time I made raspberry pineapple, still got one bottle hiding in my stash, been eyeing it. it was actually, I finished my raspberry wine and my pineapple wine that year around the same time. It's like, you know what? What would they taste like together? So So you poured them together, gave them a try. I was like, hey, that works.
Yeah,
but,
it worked.
It worked great. But from now on, I'm actually, I plan on, even though it's submitted as a recipe formula for blending, I plan on making them by fermenting them together. I always find out you get a total overall better flavor complexity when you ferment together.
Yeah, as opposed to blend. I blend mine, and it's easier for me to do it. I've never tried to. I have an orange and a key lime and a carambola wine that I do. But
ooh,
it's just
those
very
sound yummy.
Light. Yeah, they're very light, very subtle taste to them. But I blend them. I do the fruit separately, and then I blend it with Florida white grapes. And it's just a very soft taste to them and all. So, yeah, they're fun. It's just fun to make it. We talked about your peach cobbler, your black cherry cobbler, and your apple crumble wines. But I also see you have a whole bunch of stinger hard apple ciders here.
Yep, we are Utah's only hard apple cider producer. And we started making that because only wineries can make hard apple cider by federal rule, by federal law. So I had people begging me to make it. So I thought, okay, what the heck, I'll give it a try. And I gave myself a year and a half. And like I said, I nailed it out of the park in about a month and a half on that. And then I like to give it a little bit more age on it. But again, we use a straight base hard apple cider, making lots of it, getting about 1,000 gallons a weekend from my local farmer who's pressing apples. And getting it all fermented up to get myself a backlog so I can make the whole year.
And then you blend in the flavors for each one of these?
Blend in the fruits. So it's my hard apple cider. You post-sweeten it with sugar just to get the flavors down right. And then like raspberry apple cider, it is 5% fresh-pressed raspberry juice. I press it myself. I did buy it steamed one time, but it really comes out better pressed. Mint hard apple cider, I used fresh mint leaves in it. So I take it like a huge tea bag of fresh mint, and I infuse it into the cider on that one.
Ooh.
Great at St. Patrick's Day, and that's actually going to be our summer seasonal. And then our black currant hard apple cider is fresh pressed black currants, too, on that one. I press them. I pasteurize it because you never know what, if I want to wash his hands or not, so I like to do that. And although pasteurization early on in the apple cider will change the characters, when you pasteurize the fruit juice after pressing it, it doesn't change the characters as much for when you're post flavoring it. But if you pasteurize it early, it changes the sugars and it tastes wrong, is the only way to say it, for like the concentrated apple juices and stuff. If you pasteurize it early, it just changes it. So I get it untreated, unpasteurized, and then we ferment it, and then age it in maturation tanks, and give it the time it needs to really age out on cider.
What is your alcohol level on the ciders?
6.95, because I can't go above
precise.
7, or they start charging me champagne tax. Actually, we have to water them down. Our finished apple cider, if it comes in late in the season, so if they'll build up a big backlog of apples. If it comes late season, the final alcohol content's usually 7.15% before we start adding juice and stuff. But when they come in this time of year, I'm getting 7.85% alcohol content off the final fermented ciders.
So there, you really have to get them down to keep from paying that.
Yeah,
extra
but when you're adding 5% raspberry juice, that's just the cat's meow to it. So five and 7.5%. The only one that I really, all of them, because the post sweetening adds volume to it, and the juices add volume to it. The only one I ever have to have water to. Oh, I feel dirty. Need a shower after that. Is the dry apple cider, because you've got to keep it under 6.95 or you get that additional, instead of 29 cents to the gallon, it's like $4 a gallon. So you don't want that.
Ooh. No, you don't. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure people understand that, too, if they were to know. So, wow.
Yep. Oh, yeah. And so it's still the strongest cider in Utah by far. If you notice, most apple cideries around are all under 7. So,
yes.
Because that's where the tax changes.
Yeah. What's the shipping laws like in Utah? Can you ship anywhere?
Suck.
Yeah, well, yeah, but
if you're bonded in the state, you can ship to. I can ship to several states outside of Utah. I'm not bonded in those states, so the only way I can legally ship is if I have direct purchase in front of me, and then you can ship to 35 states outside of Utah. That means basically you get to pay the big old Utah tax, no discounts, anything like that. So to say, I don't ship a lot of wine. it would be true on that. But and you cannot ship into Utah either. So and they've actually got rules in place that there's bootlegging laws, and if you get caught, you get a pretty hefty fine in Utah for trying to do it. So, I do ship out this time of year. We ship a bit.
You know, it seems like they're battling you more than they're helping you, though. I mean, it's just
they're it's a tough place. But Utah, with our ski industry and our beautiful tourism industry, it's something that needs to be there, because a lot of people are like, you know, I'm done hiking today. Let's go hit a winery, and I do that in a lot of places, and so it's getting there. And it takes people stubborn as me to really change myself. And you said you talked to Doug last week, and he's a pretty stubborn guy too. And it takes people like us to really fight to change the system. And I always like
fantastic. I mean, you know, it needs to be done. Because wineries are a multi-billion-dollar business, and you don't need to. but that's just it. It can be, but you don't need to get all the money up front from the first five or six wineries. I mean, you know, if you make it more friendly, you would have more wineries opening, and you would still realize the money, but yet, you know, I don't know.
And in Utah, the Utah State Liquor Law, and this is one we actually get thrown in our face a lot, the Utah State Liquor Commission and liquor stores are there to allow purchasing of alcohol within Utah, but not encouraging it. It's actually how it's written in the law. We're fighting. I actually got put in the papers here in Utah yesterday because I went to the commission meeting and they had their audit. And the state auditor says, "Well, you need to rotate your wines at your liquor. All your products at your liquor store more. So they need to be turned over at least once a month. And so basically, if you're having anything craft, you're going to be stuck with, as I say, well, that's going to stick you to Jim, Jack, and Johnny, and then nothing else, or Kendall Jackson." Yeah. And you're never going to have any kind of craft or any kind of quality product if you only focus on turnover in liquor store. And I always put out a point, I was going to say it on my Facebook later today, is, hey, look at that. The Utah State Auditor encourages Utahns to drink more.
So you can turn
We're not
it
drinking
over.
Enough, people. Let's go.
We need to rotate this off the shelf.
That's right. Drink more, Utahns, according to the state auditor.
Well, my daughter's out there now. I'm sure she'll do her share.
And Utah's actually getting to where we're not all – when I was a kid, it was 86% Mormons. And we're getting to where it's 50-50 now.
Wow.
The only problem is of our 104 state legislators, I think it's 104 if I remember my math right, only five of them drink. There's two that are open drinkers and three that are closet drinkers. And it's like, none of the rest drink. It's like, wow. I mean, it may have changed with the election this month, but I don't think there's any more drinkers. There might be less now. It's one of those things.
That's sad.
And you guys are making the liquor laws. That's not good. Well, we also have a 7-person liquor commission and only one drinker. So on that commission, the head of the DABC is a non-drinker. Like, really? Really, people?
Really? Yeah.
That's why there's a brewery out here who has called First Amendment Lager taxation without representation. So.
You know, but I'm getting a better response from wineries here in Utah. I've contacted you, and I've got guests lined up and stuff like that. And you guys want to talk about this stuff. I mean, I just talked to Texas, and for some reason those Texas wineries didn't want to get in touch with me, didn't want to talk about it. But this is but you guys, you know, I guess you want to let people know we are wineries in Utah.
We are wineries, yeah. And Doug and I like to talk. I mean, you can't get us together in a room and get a word in edgewise.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. Jay, this has been absolutely great. I have enjoyed this tremendously. You're very knowledgeable on it. Just too many wines. But
I have a lot of fun, yeah. I mean, an hour and a half blog chat, that's a long interview.
When I'm out in Utah and I am looking at visiting my daughter next summer, I will definitely stop in and meet you and talk with you and be able to shake your hand in person. The email and address and phone number and everything for you. Give it so the listeners out there can get in touch with you if they want, or look you up if they're in the state and all that. So all pertinent information, Facebook,
the easiest
everything.
Way to find out all of our stuff is go to our website at www.thehivewinery.com. And that gets you to our webpage, and that gives you directions where of the 42 state liquor stores in the entire state you can find us, and all the stuff that we've got going on. We've got my executive assistant, who's our tasting room manager. She is fantastic at keeping our website. It's not the most polished, but it's up to date as we get it out there. That's our best one. It gives hours, locations, maps, where to buy, recipes as we give them. So really, that is our best place to do it. We're also on Facebook as The Hive Winery, and type that in, and we pop right up on that one. And if you go to our webpage, you can even get our email list. Get on our email list, and every time we release a new wine, that's at least once a month, usually twice, on new wines as they come around for the seasonal selections. You can find out what's new at The Hive Winery as well.
Fantastic. And a phone number.
Our phone number is 801-546-1997. We don't answer if we've got customers in front of us, so if you've got a question, go ahead and leave a message, and we will get back to you.
And your hours?
We are open now. Now that's considered my full-time job. We're open 11:30 to 6:30, Monday through Saturday. We are required to be closed on Sundays by state law, and we only open at 11:30 because you can only legally taste wine in Utah after 11:30. So we... if you can't taste it, there's no point in being open.
That's right. That's right. That's just amazing. You can only taste, five at a time, though.
I'm allowed to. They're working on a main rule for it, but the thing was they kind of were trying to get me to a little less, but it's a half a glass total tasting, and Utah pours, that's only 5 ounces, so most of America, that's a lot more for a glass of wine. But we're allowed to do 5 half-ounce pours. Because as they say, even the lightest of lightweights shouldn't have a problem with that.
No, they shouldn't.
Mm-hmm.
that's just sad. It is
sad. I mean, granted, we have a lot of wines to try on all that. But if you tried, right now we have 19 wines available and 3 apple ciders. If you tried them all, you need a cab.
You would. You really would. Yeah. So Utah took care of that problem for you. You don't have to worry about
that.
Yep,
and they're working on changing the rules. I'm working on fighting it because they were talking about getting us down to only 3 tastings at half-ounce pours. We're fighting them. So.
Yeah, you have to. Jay, thank you. It's been enjoyable. It's been fun. I will look forward to meeting you in the summer. I will email you and find out the name.
You had a lot of fun. I'd like to tag your blog on my thing so my customers can listen to it too.
You are more than welcome to. You can put it out there anywhere you want. That sounds like a great way to let people know about all about wine on Blog Talk Radio, too. So we always appreciate that. So, and I will email you and get the number to your friend who is just opening up, and I'd love to talk with him. He probably has some more horror stories about Utah laws and stuff since he's just opening. So,
yes, he does. And he's a quiet guy. He's kind of an engineer by training. I haven't kind of gotten him out of his shell yet. Of all the Utah winemakers, only 2 of us really talk, and you've got us both now. The rest of them, I'm an engineer by training, so I kind of describe the rest of them as kind of engineerish. You know, Mike White with Kyler Grove, nice guy, great, great wines, but getting 2 words out of him's tough.
We'll see what we can do. I've had interviews like that before, so I can handle it. So,
not like me, where
give
me shut up's the hard part. Okay. Well,
thank you very
much
for taking your time out today. And you also will look forward to seeing you when I get out to Utah probably this coming summer.
And I'll see you this summer. If it's not in June when I'm trying to get out for my vacation before all the fruit hits, I'll see you then. Because as soon as fruit starts hitting, I'm kind of a hermit in the back all the time.
Well, as long as you're there, I'll find my way back to you.
That sounds great.
All right. Thanks a lot for taking your time with us tonight.
Okay. Thank you. Have a great evening.
You too. Bye. Bye now. All right. Fantastic. Where's always can't find the clapping of the people, the applause. There we go. All right. Thank you, Jay, for the interview. It was fantastic. We are almost out of time here. We have a festival this weekend. I'm not going to play the festival thing. I'm not going to play any of that stuff. I'm just going to say you've heard it before. You know it all, and there's no reason to tell you again. So thanks for tuning in, and we'll look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks. We're closed next week. We're off next week because of Thanksgiving. Everyone, have a wonderful Thanksgiving out there. Have yourself a great great holiday, and be safe on the roads, and we'll see you in 2 weeks with another guest from Utah. So good night, everyone.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine with your host, Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida States Winery. Florida States Winery is located at 25241 State Road 52 in Land O'Lakes, Florida, 4 miles west of Interstate 75 or east of US 19 and US 41. For more information on Florida States Winery, visit the website at floridaestateswines.com or call area code 813-996-2113. The email address is corp@floon.com. That's corp@floon.com. For more information on All About Wine and future shows, please like us on Facebook at facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr or visit our website at allaboutwinebtr.com. Archived shows are available as a free download on iTunes and on our show page at blogtalkradio.com/allaboutwine. Follow the Armed Forces Radio Network on Twitter at the AFRN and on Facebook at facebook.com/Armed Forces Radio. Thank you for listening to this show. We'll see you next time on All About Wine.